Well, first of all, thanks very much for inviting me, of course. It's really a pleasure to be here. It's a wonderful place. It's my pleasure to talk to you today about some of the deepest observations of the high redshift universe. And these are very exciting because they help us to constrain the early stellar formation history of the galaxies by direct observations. And highlighted here are some of the collaborators who were involved in some of the results that I will show today. And of course, because this talk is about observational cosmology, there will be very little theory in this talk, if any. Currently, actually, the only firm theoretical relation in observational cosmology that I can detect is this one, which is the half-lifetime of relevant results based on papers published. And as you can see, it's a nice exponential with a half-lifetime of about 18 months. And relevant means that it's not wrong and not obsolete. I decide this. This is my personal relation. And so this is not an accusation of my co-workers in the field who are doing wonderful work. It's just a sign that this field is progressing really rapidly. Every year there's new data sets are being published and new things that are being discovered. But also because you're doing this bleeding edge thing at very faint objects, a very high redshift. Some of the face value interpretations of these things turn out to be historically incorrect.
Are you saying that you're reading 200 papers per month?
Papers in the field. I'm not.
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
These
are purely observational cosmology.
Reading correctly, that's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
200 per month.
It's a joke. It's a joke. Okay. Good. So I'll give a brief introduction why we want to observe high redshift galaxies directly. And I will focus also for a little bit on some of the methods that we use because they are somewhat different from the methods that Kai yesterday explained at the nearby universe, at lower redshifts, where the galaxies are brighter and where you have spectroscopy. Then some of the main results, which is the limits on the star formation, or the estimates of the star formation, but also the discovery of quiescent galaxies, already at redshifts 2 to 3, when the universe was only 2 to 3 billion years old. This was very unexpected, and work on the sizes of these galaxies, which provide independent constraints on how they evolve from high redshift to low redshift. And so, beginning at in the local universe, we know that the galaxies are adhere to certain very distinct relations and can be separated in two different classes, where at the blue end you find lower mass galaxies that are still star forming, such as a Milky Way, and that have lower metallicity, lower mass, younger stellar ages. And at the high mass end, in the present-day universe, galaxies are metal-rich, have very low star formation rates, and are nearly all regular ellipticals. These are the 1 sigma. What fractions is outside this particular? Yeah, well, you know, that's a separate discussion. But the point is that you can really distinguish these two very distinct sequences, where you have the blue galaxies that are disky, star-forming, and generally with younger stellar populations, and you have the more massive galaxies, which tend to be older and are pressure-supported rather than rotation-supported. This is redshift zero. This is well established. Now, the interesting thing is that this general picture, as Kai showed you yesterday, doesn't change a lot qualitatively from redshift zero to redshift one. So in the latter half of the history of the universe, this general picture has already been established. Now, that teaches you something very interesting about especially the formation histories of the most massive galaxies. Because even at a redshift of 0.7 or 1, these guys are already pressure supported with old stellar populations. Now, old stellar populations means a gig a year or 2 gig a year, which means that they formed most of their stars a few gig a years earlier, which means at redshift 2. So at redshift 2, the universe was only 2 billion years old, or 2.5 billion years old. So they had to make all their mass, which is 10 to the 11 solar mass of Moore, only in 1 or 2 billion years. And so that immediately tells you that the average star formation rates for these guys when they were evolving had to be on the order of 100 solar mass per year, which is much higher than the blue galaxies in the local universe.
Yeah, but you don't know how many galaxies made up this thing, so it's like 100 solar mass per year.
That's it. Exactly. So this is one of the problems that is well known in observational cosmology, that you don't, some of the results are degenerate. You don't know whether the stars have been formed in situ or whether the stars were formed in small clumps that later together merged without significant star formation. This is one of the problems. But that's only a problem if you study the relic evidence, right? If you study the end result. One of the clues is to go and observe at high redshift, where you can see these things happening while they're forming. So that's a good point, because this is exactly why you want to go to high redshift.
But however, this is 100 solar masses per year, for example, it is anyway bigger, 100 times bigger than the normal galaxy.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you study star formation in the low universe to build your templates or to understand galactic scale star formation, there's nothing similar. So this is a cautionary tale as well. The templates are derived from galaxies that are here, but there's no guarantee whatsoever that the galaxies or the galaxies that were the progenitors of these things were anything like these things. So. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it has. Yeah. If you select them by, well, unless you go to very low metallicity.
20% of the galaxies there.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes. High metallicity galaxies you find over all masses. Low metallicity galaxies you only find at low masses.
Where is Milky Way on those walls?
Somewhere around here. Where is it?
It's quite close to the tent.
Yeah. So it's sort of on the edge of.
And you said that this clump is actually not true, right?
Well, you know, the thing is, a metallicity and stellar mass map does not project uniquely to morphology. This is nothing new. What you will find is that in all structural and stellar population parameters, there is a distribution with some scatter. If you cut only in one part of parameter space, you will find a distribution in the other. So, I mean, nothing here is unique, as in you can use one to predict the other. But
not to say that this one farmer over this and this long mass over this. All long mass.
The thing is, if you cut on metallicity like 10 to 11 and on metallicity and on mass, and you just, you know, you look at the sample, what you get in terms of morphology, 70 to 80% are guys like these. So, you know, yeah, of course. And some fraction will be very massive galaxies like M31 or so. Again, there's a spread in population. I'm saying I'm going to the next slide, if you don't mind. I'm happy to discuss this, but this is just a lead-in to what I'm actually going to talk about. So this is the whole thing about how to derive stellar population parameters for the local universe galaxies. It's a very interesting talk in itself, but it's not necessarily my field. So I'd like to move on, if you don't mind, to the next part. Otherwise, I'd never be able to finish. there's some relic evidence that that also that's not something that I'm really going to talk about in depth, but there's indications that the stars in the galaxies and the black holes form together. So wherever there's massive star formation, you might expect perhaps AGN activity. Somehow black holes and the total stellar mass of the galaxies know about each other. And the reason why people have been focusing on this is that in some of the state-of-the-art models, people use feedback from an accreting black hole to warm up the gas to prevent it from condensing and forming stars. And this is one of the only ways in the current models for galaxy formation to quench star formation at early times. And so what happens is that this is a simulation from Crotone et al. These are so-called semi-empirical models, where at some point when a galaxy reaches a certain mass, AGN activity kicks in, and this moves all these blue star-forming massive galaxies to the red end and quenches them. And this then creates the a distribution that is more similar to what we see in the local universe. But of course, the question you can ask is, if you know, these models were calibrated to observations of the local universe. Now let's see what they predict. And do those predictions, how do they stack up against the real observations? And what you can see here is this is the star formation rate versus basically mass of the galaxies. And what you see is that at the present day universe, the most massive galaxies have very low star formation rates if the AGN kicks in. So this is without AGN feedback, which means that some galaxies keep on star forming until the present day. And this is with AGN feedback, and they manage to create a lot of galaxies that do not form stars anymore, which are the ellipticals. The gas is either in the primordial halo or in falling. So through accretion of other halos.
Because again, using Nick's example of the Milky Way, there's not enough gas out there for us to have
it. I mean, these are the results of their simulation. So they have an ample supply of gas, apparently. And so you would say that you have gas exhaustion at some point. But the thing is that they do account for this.
And they may be compared to the universe expansion, for
Yes.
So where's the Milky Way?
It's about in the Great Barrier.
Yeah, it's about there.
If I said that's less than 100 kilometers per second, the Birkhead law is 2.5.
No, maybe it's not. No, it's more than. It's around. It's somewhere around the line in the UV.
But the point is that. Yes. Yes, it's very hot.
It's a massive gas.
No, there's fossil groups and huge ellipticals with enormous amount of clusters of galaxies scaled down to into mass, and then all the galaxies in that one. It's fossil groups.
Right, and just like the argument of is it the gas in the galaxy or is it the gas in the group?
Well, the fossil groups are basically back at the halos of critical galaxies, that one galaxy. So the large critical galaxies do have X-ray halos.
Yeah, we should not
need those
more.
But okay, but the point here is that this is a particular model that is fairly recent. It is tuned with all the knobs, calibrated to very low redshift, where it more or less reproduces the distribution of star formation rates versus stellar mass. And then the question is, okay, so this model also makes predictions of how the high redshift universe should look like, and how does it compare to the actual observations? And the most interesting ones for this talk is the predictions of redshift 3, where you can see that the star formation rates for the most massive galaxies are invariably high. So this is 100 solar mass per year. And whether or not you have AGN eating is not so important. It will modulate the star formation, will quench it a little bit, but not to the point where it doesn't form stars anymore. So the prediction is all galaxies at redshift 3 are star forming, none of them are finished. So that's a very easy prediction to test. So how do we do this? So the methods that we're going to use, Kai outlined some of it yesterday. It's what they call the very deep multi-wavelength surveys. And I will just step you through a couple of them. So the number of fields that actually have this array of data is very few. On the whole sky, there's only 5 fields. They were very carefully selected, so you know, have no obscuring galaxies, a low column density of gas. Basically, the clearest views of the universe, or the clearest distant views of the universe. And these fields were vetted over and over again over the last 2 decades by all a variety of time allocation committees. And over these 2 decades, they have, or especially the last decade, they have assembled a stunning array of data. And so that's what makes these fields so unique. They literally have observations at every wavelength. Now, the difficulty is that in the nearby universe, you have exquisite detail for galaxies. You can resolve them, you can take spectra of them. But as we go to higher and higher redshift, and what I'm going to talk about today is redshift 2 and higher, it invariably reduces to blobology. And blobology is the art and science of interpreting amorphous blobs in imagery. And as you can see here, in the local universe, this is a picture with ACS, you see wonderful detail. You see the dust lanes of the galaxy, you see morphology, you see tidal tails. Even if you go to redshift of 0.7, this was the topic of Kai's talk yesterday, you can still make clear distinctions between the morphologies of galaxies. You can see the resolved colors. This is a tremendous wealth of information, something that you can use to decipher the formation histories of these galaxies. But what I'm talking about today is it looks all like this. And so we have almost no structural information. These are all almost point sources. But what you do see is that you can measure the colors quite readily. And so that is the whole analysis is just based on color information. And the way you do it is...
Sorry, is that a joke or is it really true?
This is really true.
You really found that...
No,
I'm going back to your
morphology. Oh, wait. Before we're going to discuss this for another 10 minutes, yes, this is made up, so. It looks pretty good, huh?
It looks very good.
Yes. They actually refer to it as a blobology. It's not an official term, but you can look it up. It depends on the telescope, but the thing is that as you go to higher redshift, to study the same rest frame wavelength, you have to go to different telescopes, to infrared telescopes, to mid-infrared telescopes. And these tend to have not the exquisite detail as you can have with ACS in the local universe, where you can study them in the optical. High redshift galaxies you cannot study in the optical because that's a rest frame far UV. And you see either nothing or something that is not representative of the stellar mass of the galaxy. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm going to talk about a whole range of things. Because if you want to talk about star formation rates, you do not want to look only at the UV, but you also want to look at the re-radiated emission in the infrared, and which is, you know, is measured very long wavelengths with Spitzer, and hence looks something that is 3 times worse than this in resolution. Spitzer, a MIPS image, for example, would look like this, a big blob. And you know, it's the challenge for observers like me is finding out how to associate flux in a big blob to any of these individual points. That's actually much of the work, which I'm not going to talk about. But when people talk about these deep multi-wavelength cosmological fields, they generally have this array of data. And so it ranges from the X-ray to the far UV, optical, near infrared, and IR. And just to explain a little bit how this translates into our limits on the stellar population parameters. Just assume this is rest frame for a minute. But the X-ray, we can get limits on the AGN activity and whether these galaxies are very luminous starbursts. From the far UV and the re-radiated emission, because some of these massive galaxies are very dusty, we can estimate star formation rates, and this is usually done by scaling with templates. And the templates come from local observations, which is a problem. And the stellar mass and the age of the galaxies are mostly inferred from observation at rest frame optical and near-infrared wavelengths, and so basically from the general shape of the SED. You can get estimates of the stellar mass and the stellar age. And the models that you would use are these are the theoretical stellar population synthesis models like Broussard and Charlot and Marston. These are the empirical templates, and these are usually scaling relations. But the most important thing is the uncertainties. And these are systematic uncertainties. Basically, if you compare one model to the next, what sort of systematic difference you might get. And for these scaling relations, it's a factor of 5. For the star formation rates, it's at least a factor of 2 to 3. And for these things, it's a factor of 2. And these are significant hurdles, and this is something that we cannot overcome. So it's just something that we have to live with. In fact, if it were only this bad, it would be pretty easy. You know, our job would be okay. But it's even worse, because again, these are blobs. They don't have spectra. So how do we get their distances? Now, the distances are derived through a technique of photometric redshifts. And photometric redshifts is basically, you have this array of imaging data, and so for every blob you have a number of colors or SED points. And now you fit these different models from the stellar population parameters to these flux points, but you solve for the distance and the stellar population parameters simultaneously. Now, you know, you can understand that this is definitely more uncertain than a spectroscopic redshift, which is usually from emission lines or absorption lines. But another problem is that some of them can have catastrophic failures. Sometimes you confuse different features in the SED, and catastrophic failures are a real problem, especially for massive galaxies, because the mass function is so steep at the high mass end. So there are many more fainter galaxies than there are massive galaxies. So if you make errors in the mass, it will boost the number of mass-limited galaxies that you find. So this is a problem, and it's something that you need to be very careful with. And the other obvious thing is that there's degeneracies. Something that you find with a solution at a slightly higher redshift might have an intrinsically bluer color, and therefore a different template fitted. So there's degeneracies between the redshift that you recover and the stellar population parameters that you infer.
It's not only for finite ratio, because finite ratio is a big business for things like RSSD.
Yes. Yeah, this is a generic problem. And the problem is especially hard at redshifts of 1.5 and higher, because there you cannot make use of those efficient optical spectrographs to calibrate the photometric redshifts. Because the whole trick is to calibrate the photometric redshifts to make perfect templates, and then hopefully it will improve. And it does, actually. You can see that the redshift half, people are getting really good at getting reliable photometric redshifts. The problem at redshift higher than 2 is as most of the features shift into the near-infrared window, you need to have near-infrared spectrographs. And multi-object efficient near-infrared spectrographs on 8-meter class telescopes do not exist. Well, one of them exists, and that's MORCS, so that's very exciting. But even then, on a multi-object spectrograph in a near-infrared with current sensitivities, you would need a couple of thousand hours to get a couple of hundred redshifts for galaxies like these. So these are major undertakings. And so that's why, for now, I mean, it will take years and years to build up a sample to calibrate the photometric redshifts. It will improve. But the point is that these photo-Zs are uncertain, there's problems with them, and to show you this, here's a demonstration of how we currently translate observations in the 24 micron band to star formation rate. Now, the 24 micron band samples the rest frame infrared, and so we use it to get an estimate of the infrared luminosity, which is powered by dust-obscured star formation. So these very massive galaxies are very dusty. Not a lot of their light is coming out in the UV. Most of it is absorbed by dust and then re-radiated at longer wavelengths. And so what you want to do is you want to measure the total infrared luminosity and then convert that to a star formation rate using some local calibration. Now, the problem is, one, you don't actually observe the real infrared because that's at much longer wavelengths where we actually don't have instruments or where the atmosphere is opaque. So what we have is we have this small telescope, 0.9 meter Spitzer, and it has a very efficient 24 micron band where we can actually detect the 24 micron image flux of redshift 2 galaxies. And so 24 microns on redshift 2, that is 10 microns in the rest frame, or 8. And so that falls in these very nice PAH features here. And these PAH features are very poorly understood. But even then, what happens is that you measure flux here, then you use a template, either this one, or this one, or this one, or this one. You can choose. There's a factor of 10 difference. And then infer the total IR luminosity, and then convert this to star formation rate. Now, here you can see what sort of differences in the inferred luminosity you get from several factors. First of all, this line is the observation on for a single observed flux at 24 micron band versus redshift. And you see that, you know, the uncertainty just because of the observation, just because of Poisson noise or the background, is very small. It's just this small line. It's about 10% or so. This is a high quality observation. The difference between this track and this track is the difference between a model. Essentially, it's the difference whether you take this template or you take this template. And that's a factor of 3 difference. And that's the factor of 3 I was referring to in the previous slide.
What is that one? You said model or empirical template?
These are empirical templates.
So these are 2 different galaxies, essentially?
Yes, yes. Well, okay, it's not entirely. This is a theoretical model that is calibrated to observations of local galaxies.
But that part that is uncertain is really a difference in the observing.
It's a difference between the strength of the interstellar radiation field. In other words, as you have more interstellar radiation, dust gets destroyed, and you have a different amount of response or re-radiated dust.
But it's understood why the 10 micron part doesn't change.
It's basically the temperature of the dust. So at this part, I mean, the difference between temperature will be most. You will see at the temperatures where it re-radiates. So this is a few hundred kelvins or so. So that will be here. So this is just this is Planck curve. So it's understood why this is always low.
But mid 160 microns, I'm assuming.
Yeah, but right? Yeah, but 160 microns at redshift 2 to 3 is hopeless. You don't reach the sensitivity by a factor of 10. And the PSF, so the resolution of the image, is 6 times bigger than MIP. So you have a beam of 24 arc seconds. Just to show you what it means, 24 arc seconds, this is 2 arc seconds. So 24 arc seconds would be a beam like this. Well, good luck assigning it to one of the galaxies. It's very hard. But you're right, that will make a difference. If you get more flux points on this SED curve, you can constrain the IR luminosity better.
But that's 70 or 6 or 8 microns.
Yeah, 24 micron. Well, this, what do you mean?
70 micron.
Yes. But it's also, yes, yeah, there's currently a very deep program on the way, But still, you have the same problems. It's not as sensitive as 24 microns, and the PSF is enormous. For example, 24 microns in a single field, you find thousands of sources. At 70 microns, you find three. You're at the high luminosity end. Things will fall off immediately. If you're a factor of 10 less sensitive, it's the difference between 1,000 galaxies and no galaxies.
So this is the difference.
But the point that I want to make, which is yes, there are systematic differences. We know this, factor of 3. But that's not our only problem. The problem is, if you now factor in the typical uncertainty of a photometric redshift, what you get is a factor of 10 uncertainty. And this is actually a very agreeable, this is delta C of 1 plus C of 0.1, or about 0.3 in the sigma. And this is a very reasonable, not untypical uncertainty of the distance of a high redshift galaxy. But you can see that whether you think this galaxy is at this redshift or at this redshift makes a factor of 10 in the inferred luminosity. And so that's the real problem. The problem is that you have this compound effect of systematic uncertainties, but also of the uncertainty of the distance. So that's a general caveat. And another caveat is that to observe massive galaxies, which are the most interesting because you can observe them directly, right? You can trace them as you go to very high redshift because they are more luminous. But the problem is that in any field, there are only so many massive galaxies. And so you have to have sufficient area. If you don't have sufficient area, then something would happen that happens with GOOTS. GOOTS is an excellent survey. It's very deep, but it's only 10 by 15 arc minutes. And so in this field, which is our new data set, which is the extended CDF South, it would fall here. Now, if we go back, if you squint with your eyes a little bit, you can see there's large surface density changes over the sky. And this is for massive galaxy in a redshift slice 2 to 3. And what you see is you see differences in the average cosmological density of factors of 3 to 4 as you move to different positions in the sky. And this is something that we know. We know that massive galaxies are very biased traces of the dark matter. So you have to have a large cosmological volume to get a reasonable average. This is a half degree by a half degree. But you can also see there's this sort of hole here in the middle. And that's where the CDF South is. So that's the general problem with those small cosmological deep fields. You have to have sufficient areas, or your estimates of average densities can be off by a factor of a few. And that point was raised yesterday also. If you want to look at different redshifts and compare the integrals at different times to see how they compare, you better make sure that each part of your cosmological volume is big enough to be representative.
Well,
small fields might have a very uncertain average density, for example.
You have enough of them to sample the whole DGF.
Yeah, but you don't. That's the problem is that.
Well, no, you don't. But you don't have to have just large fields. Just have to have enough small fields to sample.
Yeah, no. Sure. Yes, it's in fact, for many studies, it's preferable to have many smaller fields than one big field. But the point is that you want to have your total area, you need to be large enough, whether it's divided over smaller fields or as one in big field. But that's a big problem because, this alone took 8 years to build. This small part of the sky here. And this, we're still in the process of building. We're now 4 years into it. So these are major undertakings. So, results. I thought the interesting start would be to compare to some of the results that Kai showed yesterday, where this is the rest frame U minus V color versus the stellar mass for a sample in this field of galaxies at redshift of about 0.7. And this is not the same sample, but it's a similar sample as Kai was showing yesterday. And what you see is that you already see this difference in distribution where you have the blue galaxies here that are star forming, and the most massive galaxies, especially at the high mass end, that are generally not star forming. And of course, the X's are galaxies that are detected at X-ray wavelengths, and they might harbor an AGN. So, but the point is that the general distribution, the general properties, are quite similar to local galaxies.
Is it also the same very far? Because you process Sloan galaxies, is it the same U and V or the same?
Did I show U minus V? I showed B minus V. So it's this is a different color, but it's basically the same. I mean, the trend is exactly the same. But now, if you look at redshift about 2, you see that galaxies at masses higher than 10 to 11, they do exist and they are star forming. So at least half of them are star forming at enormous rates. These are rates of several hundred solar masses a year. And so what you can immediately conclude is that a certain fraction of the massive galaxies that is forming can have high enough star formation rates to form the stars in situ. So you don't, you know, if this was a mass plot or a mass function that was didn't extend to such high masses, you would argue that this is an evidence for the contrary, that you would always need to have small building blocks that you can smash together. But the star formation rates in many of these massive galaxies in early times, just 3 giga years after the Big Bang, is several hundred solar masses per year. So within a small fraction of the Hubble time, you can build up the stellar mass in these galaxies quite easily.
This comparison is not correct, right? Because you might have the same number density at redshift 2, at redshift 0.7 in terms of massive galaxies, but your survey, you are sampling a larger volume at redshift 2 than redshift 0.7, right?
This is to illustrate, if you fold in the differences between volumes, which is a rather obvious thing to do, of course, and you compare the number density of massive galaxies at redshift 2 compared to redshift 1, the difference is about 50% or so. So
50% more at redshift 2?
More at redshift 0.7.
Okay.
Of course. I mean, it's galaxies grow in mass. They generally do not decline. So what you see is that at the high mass end, a lot of galaxies were already in place or actively forming at higher masses. It's not that you're sampling here a huge volume, here a tiny volume, and this actually means that there are very few of them forming. No, there's significant, I mean, clearly less than at redshift half, less by a factor of 2, approximately. But still, there's a significant fraction of galaxies at the high mass end that can form in situ, in principle.
A factor of 2 is at the same mass.
Factor of two at the same mass bin. So say the global average density at mass is higher than 10 to 11.
So when you say in situ, then you qualify that better in terms of the beam wall is there, in terms of physical size at that threshold, for example.
I'll come to the physical size of these things a little bit later, because you know that's an interesting clue also. But in the meantime, I'd like to focus on. So this is another way of looking at the same plot. This is more how Kai was showing his results yesterday. It's a log of the star formation rate versus the stellar mass. And you can see this general trend where galaxies at the higher mass tend to have sort of an upper envelope. They extend to higher star formation rates. Note that the scatter here is much higher than Kai was showing. But that's because this relies on photometric redshifts. And so this is the added uncertainty, which you know is hopefully a random scatter. Not always, but this explains why this distribution is generally wider. But the thing I'd like to focus on for a little bit is these guys here. So this is redshift 2. Now, turns out that approximately half of the most massive galaxies have no identifiable star formation. So they are red, they're faint in the far UV, but at the same time, they do not emit any radiation at infrared wavelengths. So they also have no re-radiated dust emission. You cannot say, well, these are just dust obscure starbursts. If they are dust obscure starbursts, they would be here. So what are these things? So if you, it turns out that if you measure the stellar populations of these individual galaxies from the optical and the rest frame near IR light, and you plot the stellar population parameters versus color, and I'll explain to you in a second why you would not want to do that. So this is a rest frame U minus V color, and this is a rest frame V minus J color. You can see that the important stellar population parameters, such as the age and the dust, they correlate strongly with the color. Whereas you see that a lot of galaxies cluster here, which are very old and have very low dust content. And there's a sequence of galaxies that runs from here to there that are generally young. So they have young stellar populations, and they have a lot of dust content that increases along this line. Now, the reason why is that you want to see this actually happening as a function of rest frame color is that it can be very tricky to just fit models and hope that you can interpret the data. So if you see these very strong correlations with color, so with the general shape of the galaxy SED, it inspires some confidence that the stellar population parameters that you infer are actually things that are real. Otherwise, it's very difficult to, by eye, to believe whether a certain fit or an answer is correct. And if you now go back to... But the important point here is that if you look at massive galaxies of redshift 2, you find a lot of these galaxies with low infrared emission have very old ages and very low dust content. And this is quite similar to what you would find in the local ellipticals. So that's kind of a surprise, because it means that even at a redshift of 2 or so, you would find galaxies that are completely formed, have very low star formation rates, old stellar populations, and so by extension had formed their stars in even shorter time at higher redshifts.
So how rare or how common are those galaxies in comparison to, what's the number density?
The number density is about between 1/5 and 1/10 of the local density of ellipticals to the same stellar mass limit.
What is local density?
Some number. I can look it up in the paper for you.
So, for example,
it's 1/5.
Are they more common than comma clusters today, or less common?
Than comma clusters?
Yeah.
They're less native. They're more common than comma clusters. These are field galaxies, so they're very numerous, but they. You know, obviously, they have to have a lower density than massive ellipticals at low redshift, right? Because there are many different ways that you can make a local elliptical. They do not all form at very high redshift. Some of them are still forming at redshift 1.5 or so. But a fraction, and a fraction is, you know, roughly 20% of the local massive galaxies by number density would have already been formed at redshift 2.5.
But there was no evidence from the population of local ellipticals, the sun were assembled solar. No, we lose age resolution beyond the...
No, this is the famous, it also has to do with the famous age metallicity degeneracy. It turns out, especially if galaxies get really old, like, you know, 10 gigayears, it's very hard to pinpoint whether the galaxy is 10 gigayears or 12 gigayears or 9 gigayears. It's nearly impossible. And impossible to the degree that the stellar population models have not advanced to, are not sufficiently detailed that you can actually do this. And, you know, a local galaxy, the difference between 9 and 11 gigayears is a formation redshift from either 1 to 2.5. So these constraints are completely untied. Again, this is one of the reasons why you want to go to high redshift, where you can actually count them. This one is forming, this one is not forming, this is their mass. And again, if you look at the same plot, but now, so this is this sample of galaxies versus mass. This is the star formation rate that you infer from the IR. Again, this is similar to Kai's plot, where you see that there's this trend with mass, but at the high mass end, there's also a lot of galaxies that have no IR. This is the star formation rate that you infer from the far UV, where the blue galaxies are far UV bright, and the massive galaxies are far UV faint. And this is what happens if you add up the two star formation rate tracers, and again, you see this trend that Kai described earlier. But you see there's a lot of galaxies with no evidence for star formation at all. And at the high mass end, you see that fraction, well, it depends a little bit on where you want to put the limit, but let's say you put the limit here at 10 solar mass per year, which is not a lot for a high mass galaxy, 10 to 11 solar mass galaxy, you know, 10 solar mass per year, that's a residual star formation. In the sense, it doesn't add up much mass to the galaxy in the rest of the Hubble time. But you can see that half of them seem not to be forming appreciable amount of stars.
The rest of the Hubble time, exactly, is still double.
10 to the 10, yes, it would double, yeah. So you want to have less than that, so like so.
I'm confused, actually, on the previous plots, actually, your limits were much higher, your upper limits here.
Yes. So the difference between this and here is that because I needed extra detail, I've now switched to the CDF south, which is the central deepest area. And the reason why I did that is there we have currently the highest quality photometry and these very deep IR limits. So while the number density of these small fields are more uncertain, so you don't know actually the precise number of galaxies you have to certain limits, the quality of information on each individual galaxy is much higher. So if you want to look at the SEDs of individual galaxies, this is why we then restrict ourselves to the very deepest field. So this is why, and the limits there are approximately 10 times deeper or 20 times deeper. Anyway, and this final plot is here's the specific star formation rate. So it's the star formation rate divided by stellar mass. And that gives you an indication of how fast these galaxies are adding appreciable amounts of stellar mass to the current mass. Where one means it adds 10 times its current mass per gigayear. So these are what you call the genuine starbursts. But at the highest mass, say 10 to the 11, you find a lot of galaxies, and there's approximately, you know, half of them, that have 10 to the minus 1 or less. So 10 to the minus 1 means 10% per gigayear. So that would add exactly one, it would exactly double their stellar mass in the remaining Hubble time. But things that are here would only add 20 or 30%. So of these galaxies, you can actually claim these could have, you know, these could be candidates for galaxies that have done forming.
But you said that all those things are uncertain compact fan. That's right.
Well,
So
the calibrations are uncertain to a factor of 3, and then there's the additional uncertainty in the limits of another factor of 2 to 3. It's true. And so, but the point is, if you don't see anything, it means you just have a limit on the star formation rate, and that limit is uncertain by a factor of 5 to 10. So this could be this too. These are actually 2 sigma upper limits. So it's not that these galaxies could be here. So the individual, including systematic errors, on these individual points, it's not that they could be over here. So these are really down here, or they're down here.
Huh? That's not clear from your points.
That's true. I mean, I made this plot in a hurry. So these things are upper limits.
And it's also actually interesting to think of the duty cycle, too.
Yes. That's another point. So
it doesn't mean they have to really shut off. It's just for 100 million years now, a few hundred million years.
Yes, that is something that you can only conclude from the instantaneous star formation rate. However, if you look at all the available data, which includes the optical and the IR, you can measure the sort of the average age of the remaining stars. And so, and that is what this plot referred to.
Actually, the star formation rate, what is the average in a time scale?
What's the? This instantaneous.
Well, can it be instantaneous?
Oh, a star formation time scale, much less than a giga year. So
yeah,
the physical...
Much less, but what is it, 10 million years, 100 million years?
For the UV, which is this, you know, basically the number of OMB stars, it's the lifetime of an OMB star. So it ranges from millions to tens of millions of years. For the infrared, for the re-radiated dust, it's about the same time scale, because the time it takes from the light to be absorbed and re-radiated, that is, you know, practically instantaneous. So it's still the lifetimes of the stars. So it's tens of millions of years.
They
can be, yes, yeah.
So then you will get this very wide distribution. Even if they're physically
yes.
the same.
But the thing...
So
the, yes. Yeah, but that was the point that Tom was raising, is that if you only look at the instantaneous star formation rate over stellar mass, then you have no clue about how often these things can fluctuate between on and off. However, once you form stars and you then shut off, then those stars will have a certain color that reflects their age. And that color changes with time. And so you can have a pretty good estimate of the average stellar mass and the average stellar age of a galaxy after it shuts off star formation. And so you cannot just say, well, you know, it means that they can jump around between this and that arbitrarily, because that means that their average color would be pretty blue or pretty red if they're very extincted. But the point here that I was making in the comparison with the optical and the near-infrared data is that these red colors means that their ages are on the order of a giga year. So these galaxies here can only be red if they have shut off star formation for at least half to a giga year. So if galaxies were red and very dusty, they would lie here. So do you understand? Okay, so here you see a subsample of the galaxies now with the specific star formation rate color-coded. So essentially, oops. So if I take these galaxies here and I color-code them, where these galaxies are red, so the candidate galaxies that are quiescent, and these galaxies I color code as blue, so I color code as a function of specific star formation rate, and I put them in the same plot, it looks like this. So the galaxies that you don't see, they lie here, that you don't see in the IR. And if you now look at their other colors, so their optical and the near-infrared light, which gives you sort of the average stellar age, you see this. You see that they're all also all old. So they cannot be cycling all the time. Because if they move between dusty star forming and old, it will take a giga year before they look like this. And so using these extra information, you get a limit on what can be the duty cycle of these galaxies as well. But the important thing is that you see that there are galaxies that at whichever tracer you look, these galaxies have no star formation and they look old. And you can see it also if you look at spectra. So for a precious 36 of them, we have spectra. And these are the specific star formation rates. Again, as a fraction of their mass per giga year, but now from H alpha. So from the equivalent width of H alpha. And you see basically the same trends that the galaxies that are quiescent, they are here. The galaxies that are blue and active in the far UV, so less obscured, are here. And the ones that are very dusty and forming are there. Anyway, and so and to quantify this fraction that you see a little bit firmer, you can throw all the galaxies lower than a certain mass limit away. So this is removing all the galaxies that have masses less than 10 to the 11 solar mass. So this is a mass limited sample. And then you see, if you just count the fraction that are active versus the fraction that are passive, about 50% of the galaxies are quiescent. So 50% of the massive galaxies at a redshift 2 to 3 are quiescent. And that's quite different than what you would have expected from certain models, where you would expect that they're all actively star forming.
Or you shouldn't really take those models very seriously, because the AGN energy feedback is enormous. And there's 30 times more energy in AGN than in supernovae. Then you put out some model, and they get the sign right straight to zero, but they won't even get the sign of the derivative, right?
Yes. No, I mean, I would phrase it differently. I would say you need to take the models very seriously, and you should have them make predictions, and you should compare those to observations, and they can do whatever they would like to modify the models. But if you start off by saying, well, you know, these models are nonsense anyway, so what's there to do then? I mean,
I don't understand what AGN do to the galaxies. How AGN feedback actually occurs, and what are the sequences?
Yes, but how would this magically appear? I mean, this would appear also through comparison with observations. I mean, as the observations get increasingly detailed, and for some of the galaxies we would be able to get spectra, then you can see this process of AGN feedback, for example, happening, you know, as it occurs. And
can you also phrase it more constructively in the sense that I mean, all these models actually would also predict a very large scatter. So the line you're showing is a
relation. Yes.
Because in any model people could go through, they would have very large scatter.
Yeah.
Then would relate directly to what you're showing.
Yeah. But in any case, it's important to actually take the models and have them predict things and compare to the data. So 50% of these galaxies are quiescent. They have not been star forming in a while, so they seem to have shut off, perhaps indefinitely. Now, another immediate question that you want to ask is these quiescent dead galaxies at redshift 2, do they evolve directly, passively, into the massive galaxy that you see at redshift 1 or 0.7, or maybe even the local universe?
Actually, sorry, can I go back to the open galaxy? Unless, is it the average star formation rate?
Yes.
So then if your 50% of galaxies have zero star formation rate, another 50% have 100, your average is 50.
Yeah, so our average
is... Your only changes this line by factor of 2 when you make 50% non-linear.
Yes.
On top of it, actually, that's the amount of gas that cools. That's not necessarily the mass.
No, that's correct, yes. And a lot of it can be blown out as well. No, yeah, it's true. This is not the best figure to compare against. What we did this year is to look at the distribution.
Right, because the star formation efficiency, how much the cool gas actually turns into stars, everybody here would say it's much lower, you know, than a factor of just 50%. So you could say, oh, we don't have enough.
Yeah.
Well, no, because if there is some kind of self-regulation, you would have to turn the same mass rate that cools into stars. There will be some kind of, if there were a steady state, there would be the self-regulation rate, essentially, under steady state.
Well, this
is not the amount of cold gas relative to the number of stars. This is the mass rate that can cool, that it has to be in steady state to the conversion of gas into stars. So that will be a good approximation for the star formation rate.
You could still have 5% star formation efficiency in the stars themselves.
This is a rate, this is not an efficiency.
Right.
No, the efficiency is still per, like 5% per free fall time, 2% per free fall time. So if you get very dense, then you have lots of free fall.
So the final thing that I want to just briefly discuss is that you want to relate the observations of these galaxies even without any particular model to the galaxies that you observe at a different time. Now, the problem there was purely from the stellar populations, this is very difficult because galaxies can maybe restart star formation and look completely different. So you don't know whether you're comparing the exact same galaxy to each direction. But one additional amount of piece of information that you can use is their sizes. Now, the reason why this has developed so very slowly is that for the sizes to measure, you have to have near-infrared observations at space-based, which is very scarce currently. And so the reason why you want to look at the sizes of these galaxies is that the size versus the mass of a galaxy that passively evolves with time doesn't change, or doesn't change appreciably. So if you have a galaxy in redshift 2 and has a certain mass and a certain size, and you find a similar distribution of masses and sizes at redshift 0.7, you can make an argument that these can be the direct progenitors of the galaxies. And we will see that that if you do this exercise, you run into something quite unexpected. So what we did is we took very of a small sample, only 20 galaxies total or so. We took a very deep imaging with NICMOS to get the distribution of the Rostrum optical light. This is where the bulk of the stars emit the light. And so you're not influenced by residual traces of star formation, which you would have if you would image them with ACS. And so what you see is that it is indeed very important to look at the distribution of stellar mass, because the morphologies of many of the galaxies in the NICMOS, this is in the H band, at 1.6 micron, is very different from the, or can be very different from the morphologies in the ACS, apart from the fact that many of them have nothing in ACS at all, and that's because they're red. But the striking correlation that we found, and of course, and this is, although fairly sampled, still based on a very small sample, what we found is that the galaxies without NIPS detections, so with low star formation rates, and with these very old profiles, so with the optical to near-infrared color that showed that they have very old stellar ages, they were invariably very small and very compact, so on the order of a kiloparsec in size. And here you see image stamps of these individual galaxies, and this is after a FIT removed. So this is deep NICMOS imaging in NIC3. And so the...
These are
10 to 11 solar mass guys. Within a kiloparsec. And so you can immediately see that there is something going on that is might be a problem. In contrast, the galaxies that are actively star-forming, the ones with NIPS detections, and the ones also that with the stellar population parameters showed that they had clear evidence of active ongoing star formation, whether very obscured or unobscured, they're all very extended. Or they had a range of sizes. They could also be compact tranquil starbursts, but many of them, most of them, were actually extended disk-like galaxies. So what you immediately see is that the surface mass density of these old galaxies was super high. And this is shown in the plot here. Well, the axis didn't really come out very well. So this is the surface mass density in solar mass per kiloparsec squared. And this is 10 to the 9, this is 10 to the 10. And this is the stellar mass, 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12. And these are the galaxies from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. So these are the relations at redshift 0. And you can see that the central surface mass density of local galaxies is fairly well constrained. This is, I'm not sure whether it's 1 sigma or 2 sigma. Anyway, it's
a... Stars, open circles.
I will explain the rest of it. The star-forming galaxies in our sample are the stars that you see here. The open circles are the galaxies that were identified as very low star forming quiescent slash dead, red and dead. And they have surface mass densities that are at least 10 times higher than local galaxies. Now, the important point to realize is that if you let a galaxy evolve passively, just let it sit in place and do nothing, it would not move in this plot. Because it doesn't change appreciably in stellar mass, because it doesn't do anything, and it has a certain size which it keeps. I mean, the sizes do not change out of themselves. So, so the stunning thing was, and we compared this also with observations at redshift 0.7, is that if you look at the distribution of surface mass densities of galaxies, these guys are way off. They're a factor of 5 to 10 off, and in terms of their implied number density, which you would find at the local universe or at redshift 7, they are a factor of 50 times more prevalent. So 50 to 100 times more prevalent. And so, whereas in the local universe you find almost none of these galaxies, at high redshift, a significant fraction of them are so compact.
Sorry, before you said that you were talking about objects larger than 10 to the 11 solar masses. There are only 2 points, or 3 now, about 10 to the 11 solar masses.
Yeah, so this is a Krupa M. So and everything is scaled 0.3 decks to here. It's a different IMF, and it's still the same. It's the same point. And also, what you have to realize is that this is not one sample. This is results from different samples. This is galaxies from the HCF South, so which is an even deeper view of than compared to the Chandra Deep Field South over an even smaller field. This field is 5 arc minutes squared. And as a result, in an area of 5 arc minutes squared, you don't have many massive galaxies. This goes back to the first plot that I showed with the large field, that if you want to have massive galaxies in a representative amount, you have to have a very large coverage, very large field. As you go to smaller and smaller ones, you have a very large differences in the numbers of massive galaxies. So the fact that you have so few here in this plot, it's first we have only have imaging for a few galaxies, and they were selected from an ultra small deep field.
But in the local galaxy, the gray area, if you go to 10 to the 12, and then you select only the central kiloparsec, will you get the surface density?
No. If you go, for example, also to the large disk galaxies, if you look just at the bulges, the profiles of their bulges. Again, their central mass densities are much softer and they're much larger, they're much lower.
And a little bigger ellipticals, you never find.
No. The central surface mass density of big ellipticals in the local universe is very well known.
So where do they go to happen?
Huh? Exactly. So that's the whole question. I'm not claiming any model. I'm just showing you this. If you look at the high redshift universe, you look at these candidate dead galaxies, you suddenly find that they have properties that are very uncommon in the low redshift universe. And so, the simplest conclusion that you the simplest thing that you could conclude is somehow you have to get rid of them between redshift 3 and redshift 1.
Maybe that's a factor of that error.
Huh?
You still have, even if you have galaxy direction of 2, they just don't sit there, right? They merge with them. So presumably these compact cores, they merge with each other.
Yes.
And go down to the ellipticals.
Yes. This is, for example, by the way, the factor of 10 differences refer to the star formation rate. The stellar masses, the uncertainties are more the level of, a factor of 2. If you include everything, including photometric redshifts. And the factor of 2 is what is shown here in the dotted line here. So that's approximately this range. So factor of 2 is not going to be...
You're using an area that's a factor square error in the distance. And that's
in the size. No. In the mass, no, right?
Well, that's it's, the surface density on the left.
Yeah, but the error in the mass is only factor 2.
But you have the surface density, which is
mass
area.
Yeah, so and it's still the integrated mass.
He's talking about area now.
Okay, the area is not a thing.
Yeah.
The area that goes back to how well can you measure an error and a size based on this thing, on these data.
And I think what Kapal is asking about the redshift uncertainty, if it's very than actually
the error with the square.
Yes. Well, why?
Is the distance that gives you the size, that gives you the area, the square.
It's not part of 10, but the 0, 1 plus 10 is more.
Delta 0 for 1 plus c for this sample is 0.07. So the delta z is 2.5 times 0.07. So that's a 0.17 or so. So 0.17 to, you know, it's not a huge factor. The most important factor is actually the uncertainties in the models that you would use to infer the stellar population mass or the stellar mass. So the implication is that somehow you need to get rid of them. This is a particular model that merges those things together. Right, so you have to have two quiescent galaxies, smash them together, make sure they don't form any stars. Because if they form a lot of stars, you would be back at the same problem again. In principle, it is possible. But you know, the question always is it, why is it likely that these things merge with themselves instead of with other, more gaseous star-forming galaxies?
That's why I ask whether they're more numerous than coma clusters. And because if those actually proto clusters, they would all merge together.
Exactly. The only thing is that this is data from the Hubble Deep Cool South. The chance that you would find a cluster as massive, for example, as coma, is very small. So, you know, there's a statistic. If you take a blank field survey in any point in the sky, it's statistically unlikely that you run into a very massive cluster. But but I agree. If these galaxies or some of them share halos and they actually fall into each other and then they will merge, then that picture is correct. And one of the reasons that you can study it is if you get very large samples of this, of these systems, you can study their clustering properties. And through the clustering properties, you know, two-point correlation functions, you can estimate if they live in similar halos. Redshifts are going to be very hard for the foreseeable future. So one easy way would be to just get redshifts for all these things, because then you can see whether they're in the same halo or not.
Well, how is the comparison ratio of 0.7? If you put 0.7 data points here.
Oh, that's pretty much the same as this. It's the same as the local relation, yeah.
So they have merged then?
By then, yeah. So there's the deep ACS survey, the GEMS. Mm-hmm. And they don't find, or they hardly find any of these systems in redshift 0.7. So by then you have to have to get rid of them. Sorry, that's it.
Can I ask one reflection on? So the one possibility you're talking about is that you're going to merge the 10 and 11 by, you're going to make 10 and 12 by.
Yeah.
But you emphasized earlier that the mass functions are extremely steep.
Yes.
So from the numbers you have, if I merged all the 10 and 11 guys, do I get too many 10 and 12?
No, it can be done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, but 10 and 12 are only under 12. So the things like in a coma cluster.
All the massive galaxies that you see at high redshift will end up in very rich groups.
Right.
Yes. But coma is a big boy.
Well, okay, it's a
big
coma.
If you take it literally and you just...
It's a central elliptical thing, fossil groups and things like that.
Exactly. Yeah, no, it's pretty likely that almost all the massive galaxies you see at high redshift will end, and you also can infer that from the clustering properties, they will end up in massive groups, at least at the local redshift Oran clusters. But the very massive clusters themselves is a very special place, where it's very, those are very uncommon, and where these are the average galaxy, the average field galaxy at redshift 2.
So I'm somewhat confused by talk, because you first started on this classical line, right, that is old red dead ellipticals, and now you said something new, right, which technically, am I right to interpret this, that based on this we can say that it's not true that the field ellipticals, which we see today, we have a place of redshift 2 and 3?
Well, no, the thing is, what I said earlier is that you find these galaxies with very evolved set of populations, the high redshift. But that doesn't tell you anything about what's happened later.
Right.
Right? So I have made no claims whatsoever that I say, well, they...
You said something is consistent with the engine at all, no, by the line.
No. That's the question. I say we find these galaxies that have very evolved populations. Now, how can we tell whether these can, in principle, evolve passively to the present day? And for that, you need actual information. Hence, the NICMOS observations, which are, space-based near infrared data, which is still very scarce. That's why you have very few galaxies. But for the few that you see, you find that they're very compact, and so they cannot know, and so something has to happen. But this is based on a sample of 3 or 4.
What are the points? This is the field circles. No.
So the field circles are from the UDF, which is the ultra deep field, which is a study by Manuel Dadi. And we just took his number and plugged them in. And he didn't raise the point in his paper, but it turns out that if he'd done the same analysis, he would have found the same thing. That's from a paper a year earlier. So this is from another special field, very deep near infrared data, but very small. And so, the way forward, of course, is with some of the new facilities that are coming online. And one of them is the upgrade next year, hopefully, of the Space Telescope with WIFFI. So the new infrared camera has a survey speed that is 15 to 20 times higher than NICMOS. So you can survey large areas of the sky to even deeper limits. And
much harder to observe in the water.
This is a mock that they use for training purposes. Yes, I think somebody would be fired if that was amazing. Another way forward is, and that's what I want to call to your attention to, is that Spitzer, the cryogenic mission, is near the end of its lifetime. And so in a year or so, it cannot do very long wavelength cold observations anymore. But what will happen is that the 3.6 micron, the 4.5 micron bands, they will continue to operate on peak efficiency. In fact, they will even be a little bit more efficient. And so the hope is now that, or the expectation is that the mission will be extended by another 5 years. And that will mean that there's 5 years of almost unlimited imaging at these wavelengths with Spitzer, which opens the possibility of huge programs. And so I encourage you to look online. There are several white papers now on SRPH that explore the type of survey strategies that people can propose to do. And for this, you have to think big, like mini space missions, thousands of hours per program. There's an estimate that there will be approximately 40,000 hours available, divided over all programs. And another very exciting prospect starting next year, but fully operational probably in 3 or 4, is ALMA. Because one of the problems was that we wanted to go to the larger wavelengths to get the infrared luminosities and maybe even spectral tracers in the infrared to understand whether it's star formation, but also whether there's AGN activity. And with the normal ground-based telescope, this is very hard. But ALMA is going to be an enormous array with a total service area, I think 70,000 square feet or so. So that's going to be an amazing facility, which also has the resolution to resolve these galaxies. Instruments like SCUBA, their single array bolometers, they only have a resolution of 15 arc seconds, which is 10 times bigger than the average galaxy at redshift 2. But these will be able to actually resolve down to resolutions better than an H16. So that will be very exciting. Yeah, square meters, but I'm not sure. 7,000 square meters.
Herschel can probably do
so. Herschel is going to be very interesting, especially because it's a 3.5 meter wide, so it has better PSF. The problem is that it's passively cooled, and so it's going to run about 80 kelvins, I think. And so its own background will be pretty high, and therefore it will be fairly limited in sensitivity. In fact, a cryogenic Spitzer is more sensitive than Herschel will be. But Herschel has the advantage of the angular resolution. So yeah, Herschel will make a next step, But I'm not sure that's going to be the breakthrough, as in, you know, opening up a whole new window in parameter space. I think that's a role that is for Om. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So, Pepper, do you have questions? I'm waiting for people to have questions. I guess I had one question on the galaxies that are already, particularly very massive galaxies, are already in place. And I gather it had stopped forming stars a while earlier.
Yes.
So, do you infer extremely high star formation rates for them, and what are the prospects for observing them at high redshift when they were forming stars?
Yeah. Now that's an excellent question. Yeah, the number density of those old systems at redshift, 2.5-ish, is sufficiently high that you would expect to see the progenitors in large fields at higher redshifts quite easily. And so we're now assembling the data in this larger field to hopefully look for the brightest examples of these things. And there have been almost sporadic claims about finding galaxies as early as redshift 5 and 6 that are very dusty, obscured, maybe star-forming, but already very massive. In principle, you would be able to see them quite easily because the inferred star formation rate is going to be several hundreds of solar masses per year. I think ALMA is going to find them no problem. Whether you can find them in imaging will also depend on whether you would be able to infer the correct redshift. And that might not be very easy, because if these are very dusty, obscured starbursts, their SEDs will be almost power laws. They won't have large features which we use to pinpoint the redshift. And so the challenge will be that these things may be bright enough in principle, but it will be difficult to infer their distance just from the photometry. And spectra is going to be out of the question. Spectra with no
Herschel brain. Be able to see them also?
Yes, I think so. But again, detection of the source is usually not a problem. It's inferring the intrinsic properties.
I should talk to you because I'm working with the time shot 40, so we think we can infer the ratio.
Okay, yes. So
even part of the red.
Right, from the constraining the bump, basically. Yeah. Yes, if you can constrain the redshift, then you would be able to see. Yeah, these are going to be very bright. Yeah.
Regarding, again, the same galaxies, if you assume that they were already of that kind of size when the stars were formed, because they're probably at least a year-old.
Yes.
Yeah. So would that be a problem based on number counts for color matter models?
No, I mean...
Those guys assemble at those redshift in their number.
No, the few galaxies that you would expect to form at redshift 5, they form when the universe is much denser, and so you would expect them to have smaller physical sizes.
No, I'm not concerned about the size. I'm concerned about that mass of galaxies assembled at that high redshift in that number density. For the other matter,
right,
which is a hierarchical build-up.
Yeah, I think the jumping from... So, let me put it like this. There are enough massive halos and enough baryons around to, in principle, to make these things. So that's not a problem. But the problem is that we don't really understand how galactic-scale star formation goes in very massive galaxies. So it's not a problem of not having enough halos or not having enough baryons in those halos. There's no number density problem. The other thing is that...
You mean you have the colder matter prediction would be that you have enough collapse to be realized of that mass at that redshift.
Yes.
I'm not talking about redshift 2, I'm talking about the redshift.
Yes.
The solar form.
Exactly.
Yeah, there are more halos than the number density of the field.
Yes.
But the problem is you have to have the star formation beginning at redshift 15 to get the ages right at the redshift 6 of galaxy.
Well, that's... Perhaps. I mean, again, so estimating the ages of this galaxy is a dicey issue in itself.
Yeah, right.
So for example,
again, for the galaxies that we observe at 2.5, redshift 2.5, and with the quality of the photometry that we have, we can, for example, infer an age of a gigayear. Well, an age of a gigayear, that's only redshift 4.5 formation, right? So that's not so much a problem. But the uncertainties on the ages are maybe a factor of 1.5, perhaps 2 even. And so now it could be 1 or it could be 2 gigayears. Now 2 gigayears is going to be a problem. Because, you know, formation or completion at 2.5 gigayears and with an age, an average age of 2 gigayears means they should have made the bulk of their stars when the universe was a half a gigayear old. Yeah, that would be a problem. But I don't think that...
But you don't like that we're being C2A, right? Because you only know the age.
That's another thing. They could have, you know, formed in smaller clumps and smashed together. The other thing is that the limits on the age are not very strong. So you would actually, what you would like to have is find examples of these systems at even higher redshift, redshift 4, redshift 5. And if they are even old, then it's going to be really interesting. Because then, you know, the constraints become tighter and tighter. But I don't believe, I mean, there are a few candidates for them, but they are debatable.
Well, the universe is cyclic. If it goes to the cycles of the weekend, then maybe the left one will be the
cycle. That's a good point. You should write a table.
So, these galaxies, messy galaxies, are redshift 2. Are these counterparts of Lyman break galaxies? Are like redshift 4, 3, 4?
So, some of the Lyman break galaxies at redshift 2.5 could plausibly fade into a massive red system at redshift 2.5.
It's convex system.
Yeah, I mean, there's things, when you cut off star formation, things become red really quickly. So you only need 500 million years. And so, you know, given that the galaxy is already sufficiently massive, that's another issue. There are not that many Lyman break galaxies at redshift 3.5 that are massive. Yes, they could fade into a red system at redshift 2.5.
But you can ask the question differently. You should see at least as many as massive galaxies in the Lyman break population. If you say that they're only a gigayear old, but let's say that you believe the photometric age, then it means that if you go backwards enough, you should see the Lyman break population.
So the thing is that Lyman breaks...
Well, maybe after, you know, not maybe after gigayear.
Okay, so what I didn't talk about, but that's a separate issue, is that if you make a cut of all the massive galaxies at redshift, say between 2 and 3, and masses higher than 10 to 11, then you find that 80% are not Lyman breaks. So Lyman breaks are only 20% of the massive galaxies, maybe even less, maybe even 15. Because the way they're selected to be UV bright, and so the bulk of them will be lower mass, you know, smaller galaxies. At redshift 3.5, this whole study has not been carried out. The Lyman break part has been carried out. There are some Lyman break galaxies, and even fewer of them are massive. But we don't know how many red galaxies there are at redshift 3.5, because at this point the Balmer break starts shifting into the K band. And so, you know, this, you're gonna, even with, you know, K-selected surveys, you're gonna see only the UV part of the SED. And so in the current surveys, which were all K-selected, these things have not been discovered yet. So this is an area that has not been studied, such as 3.5 and higher. That will be done, but the problem is that we need to have the deep near-infrared data. We have plenty of Switzer data, so they are probably lurking around in the data somewhere, these redshift 3.5 massive galaxies. But we have not been able to study them because we lack a large area near infrared data to get the color.
When you say near infrared, which we are
looking at? Near infrared. Like,
you have Switzer, right?
So. Well, yeah, Switzer, not enough. You have to have Switzer and lower wavelength data.
Oh, so you want like 2.2 micron.
2.2 micron, 1.6 micron, 1.2 micron, yeah. But preferably, yeah, the deep K bands, 2.2 microns.
So how can I really get this structure?
I don't believe that's sensitive enough.
But the same telescope size has different, right?
But what's the beam size going to be? But I don't know. I don't know how that stacks up against 8-meter ground phase.
Okay, let's thank you.